Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest on this edition of the program is award-winning author Dinau Mengistu, a native of Ethiopia who came to the United States with his family at the age of two. Mengistu is the recipient of numerous awards for his novels and nonfiction pieces, which open a window into the little-explored world of the African diaspora in America. Mr. Mengistu is also a professor and the Lannan Foundation Chair of Poetics in the Department of English at Georgetown University here in Washington. Dinau Mengistu's most recent book, All Our Names, is the story of two young men who come of age during an African revolution, but who are driven apart, one into deeper peril as the revolution gathers force, and the other who immigrates to a small Midwestern town in the United States and falls in love with his young Caucasian caseworker. All Our Names moves back and forth between the young African immigrant, whose name is Isaac, and his social worker, Helen, both narrating their own chapters in an intimate and reflective tone. Dinau Mengistu creatively plays with time throughout the novel, interweaving both stories, so we witness both Helen and Isaac's timeline of events. Dinau Mengistu is the author of two other award-winning books, The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears and How to Read the Air. We'll talk with Dinau about his most recent book, All Our Names, and how his own origins as an immigrant from Ethiopia and his travels have inspired his writing. And Dinau Mengistu joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
We're really honored to have you, and I want to congratulate you on your terrific new book.
Well, thank you very much.
It's really extraordinary, and I urge all our listeners to get a hold of this book, All Our Names. But first, Dinau, talk about what prompted you to write this specific novel, and how have your own travels and personal experience as an immigrant from Ethiopia informed your writing?
This novel began, I think, really with this idea that I wanted to narrate from a narrator story set in Africa from a particular place and from a particular point in time. And I was curious about telling a story that began with this moment of hope and optimism that emerged shortly after independence. And so the novel really began there with a group of young friends on a college campus in Kampala, coming up with new names for themselves and trying to imagine a sort of bright, exciting future. And once that began to take place, I also realized that the novel was going to have a secondary part, which would be the narrative that follows all that hope and optimism. What happens when some of the men who were sort of great revolutionary leaders and inspiring figures devolved into becoming tyrants and autocrats? As a novelist, my other two books kind of had similar themes. You know, I've been sort of working through these problems of migration and the effects of conflict on our lives and how we carry those conflicts with us when we leave our homes and are forced to resettle into a different country. And my other two novels looked at that experience oftentimes from the point of view of somebody in the diaspora, from the point of view of somebody who's left Africa and has come to America and is struggling to readapt and build a new home for themselves. And this novel gave me a chance to actually work my way backwards to a certain degree, to start the story actually in Africa and stay there for a long period of time and see how these characters become active agents in the shaping of their country's history.
And let's turn to your own experience. Your parents came to this country. You were only 2 years old. Mm-hmm. What prompted them to leave Ethiopia?
My father left just before I was born in 1978, so 4 years after the fall of Haile Selassie and 2 years after the Red Terror. And, you know, during that time, there's a lot of bloodshed and a lot of violence, and a lot of members of my family and my father's family in particular were either killed or ended up in prison. And so my father left partly because he knew I was about to be born and he wanted to settle into a better place and have a chance at a better future, both for him and, of course, for his family. And then it took my mother, his sister, and I 2 years to leave and follow him into the United States.
And to what extent have those experiences informed your writing?
enormously. You know, it's hard sometimes to place the value on that because so much of my identity, so much of my work is shaped by these sort of dual narratives, you know, the narrative of both lives in Africa and lives in Ethiopia, and then, of course, the lives that happen here in the United States, the lives of people in the diaspora. And so my own life has been very much the sort of oscillation between these two landscapes, between these two cultures and political histories. And so as much as possible, whenever I've found my way into writing both fiction and nonfiction, it seems to be an almost inevitable attempt to try to figure out how to bridge these two worlds, you know, how to create characters, how to create stories that can encapsulate both the sort of political and private realities of a life in Africa, and also at the same time, how that life looks once it's been relocated and transformed into an American context.
It sounds like you're describing your most recent book, All Our Names. That's precisely what I got from the book, this incredible ability to, in a sense, make this bridge between the two cultures. And talk about, for example, the experience in America when the protagonist, Isaac, comes to the United States and settles in this small Midwestern town in also the 1970s. Yeah. It seems to me there's some sort of parallel, perhaps not a revolution or a revolution gone wrong in the United States, but we're witnessing racism, a small town. And talk about that.
You know, one of the things that I love about fiction, that I love about literature, is that it gives us an opportunity to take narratives and stories that we oftentimes fail to think of as being intricately related. And so oftentimes we think of the lives and stories of what happens in Africa as being radically different from what happens in the West or what happens in the United States. And so I say this novel began very much with wanting to create a story set in this moment of optimism after the end of the colonial era. Once that idea emerged, I also realized that something similar was happening in the U.S. at the same time. You know, 1962, you have the independence of Uganda, and 1963, you have the March on Washington with the Civil Rights Movement. And so you have here in the U.S. this burgeoning independence movement, you know, the sort of accretion of rights and of dignity for people who had been denied that. And so inevitably, these stories needed to find ways of echoing one another. And just after that same period in the United States, we also witnessed, I think, a lot of frustration and disappointment that for all the gains achieved by the civil rights, there was still an enormous amount of economic disparity. You know, there was the assassination of Martin Luther King in 1968, the riots that followed, and still the sort of persistent discrimination and segregation that continued to haunt a lot of places in the U.S. In something similar, I believe, at least on the emotional scale, when you talk about individual lives and characters, I found that same disappointment and frustration. I was able to locate that in my characters in Africa, to think about these young men who came to this college campus hoping to be leaders, hoping to be writers, hoping to be artists, and finding that despite independence, despite the sort of emergence of a new African leadership, they were still walled off. They still didn't have access to their country's resources because those resources were in the process of becoming usurped by their leaders.
Talk a little bit about the character Helen, the caseworker that was assigned to Isaac, who emigrated to this Midwestern town. She was also a fascinating character, somewhat very tolerant. She became attracted to Isaac. They had a relationship. And yet she also was battling this larger context of racism and prejudice.
Yeah. And, you know, my other two novels, they were both told through the point of view of the migrant, through the point of view of the person who's been forced to leave their home and all the challenges and obstacles they face in acclimating to this new culture and new environment. And with this story, Helen, half of the novel is her voice, is her story. And to some degree, that's one way of trying to show that, you know, migration is dynamic conversation. We need to look at it from both sides. So Helen was a chance for me to explore the point of view of the person who's actually at home when these new people arrive, and they have to make the decision to either welcome this man into her house and into her home and inevitably into her heart, or of course to reject him. And the fact that she does choose to open her heart to him and falls in love with him and tries to build this fragile, delicate, and at times tragic relationship that's burdened both by their own individual histories, but of course by this persistent discrimination, by the fact that a black man and a white woman walking down the street in a small town in the Midwest in the 1970s would have made a lot of people very uncomfortable.
Indeed. And I was wondering to what extent in Isaac there's some of you. Is there some autobiographical elements to this particular novel and to Isaac in particular?
The part that's probably the most autobiographical about Isaac is he leaves his home in Ethiopia to go to Kampala, not because he's very politically aware of what's happening in the country at that time, but because he knows that in 1962 there was this conference of African writers at Makerere University, and that idea holds this enormous promise to him. And so he's drawn to the city because the memory and the legacy of that event holds this enormous imaginative power for him. He thinks, well, because these men gathered there, because they went on to sort of become great writers, that that possibility might be open to him. So he arrives in Kampala with the dreams of becoming a writer. And obviously, of course, it's hard not to find ways of saying that echoes my own life. But also in many ways, you know, my life has obviously been much more fortunate, much more privileged than the lives of my characters. But I do like that the voice that he has. You know, he has the voice of a writer. He's somebody who's very concerned with watching and seeing the world. And some of the work that I've done as a journalist in Africa is very much reflected in his perspective and in his story. When you're writing as a journalist from conflict zones, you're both there and not there. You know, you're there to witness and to watch and observe, but at the same time, you recognize your place as the outsider. You know, you're not there to engage or to sort of control or to fight, but you're there to bear witness to some degree. And in Isaac, whether it's intentional or not, much of what he does throughout the novel is actually to bear witness. He's there to watch this revolution grow and emerge, to watch his best friend transform from an idealistic young man into a revolutionary leader.
Before we go to a break, talk about the title. What does the title mean, All Our Names?
You always want to leave some space for the reader, of course, to invest the title with their own meaning. But I do like this idea that our identities are nowhere nearly as fixed as we tend to think of them as being, that our identities are shaped by not only where we are right now in the present moment, but of course by the things that have preceded us. And so they go through lots of different names. They make up new names for themselves. They give themselves nicknames. They shed their names also in order to become freer, in order to become more independent. And so as many ways as possible, I wanted to sort of to push those boundaries of what we think of as being our very solitary, monolithic identity, when in fact, I think our identities are very complex. You know, we need to allow space for multiplicity in our lives.
So in a sense, it's like a metaphor for multiple identities.
Definitely. And when you leave your home, and oftentimes I think especially when you leave your country, you're forced to reimagine yourself in radically different ways. It's not just that you've left home or that you've left people, but that some part of you is left behind and a new part of you has to be recreated. At the same time, you know, when you fall in love with somebody, you become a new person to some degree, or parts of you change. And so you're always making room for those new selves, for those new identities that are, it's not that we necessarily shed the old ones, but that we accumulate more versions of ourselves.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Dinao Mengistu. He's the author of the recently published book, All Our Names. He's also a professor at Georgetown University in the Department of English. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And as always, we love to hear from you. Please send your feedback to PCUSA@voanews.com. Tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program, either via the radio or the internet. And here's a shout out to longtime loyal listener Ray Ondoro from Nairobi. Well, back to you, Dinao Mengistu. Let's pursue the novel a bit more and talk about how you chose to pick the Midwestern town in which the American part of the novel is set.
Probably based on two parts. You know, after my family left Ethiopia, we came to Peoria, Illinois, which is a medium-sized town very much in the heart of the country. It's a very, in some ways, quintessential American town with one large Caterpillar factory that dominates the industry. And I spent my first, you know, 7 years in the U.S. growing up there in a very all-American sort of childhood. And it was only as I grew older that I began to realize how difficult that must have been for my parents who had left Ethiopia, had left their family, and had suddenly found themselves in this very, what I imagine to be, bizarre place. And so I've always been fascinated by trying to reimagine that experience to some degree, by imagining what happens when somebody like my father, or like my mother, or in the case of this novel, when someone like Isaac leaves home and comes to this place in the Midwest and has to resituate themselves not only in a different country, but in a particular place and culture that seems even more alien than, say, if you came to New York or to Washington, D.C., where you already have a history of migration and you have other cultures and you have perhaps a community waiting. But what happens when you go to a place like that? Well, you often don't don't have a community and you often don't have people who look like you, who know where you've come from, who even know where your country may be on a map. And so there's sort of a profound sense of alienation that you can explore by locating a story in a space like that. And at the same time, you know, there's something symbolically important about the Midwest. It's that middle ground in the U.S.'s cultural history. So you have the South and the sort of history of deep segregation and the supposed ideas of liberalism that we invest in the North. And then you have these spaces in the Midwest that are neither deeply segregated nor as conceptually liberal as some of the North cities in the North, like New York or Boston, would be. And so you can play with that strange middle ground in different ways.
Well, it was very effective, as was the format of the novel, this alternating chapters, one chapter written by Isaac and the other by Helen. How did you come up with that idea? And I must say, as I said, very effective, suspenseful. Once you finish one chapter by one character, you're wondering, you know, what he's going to or she's going to say in the next time. But you're in the meantime, you have to read the chapter by the other protagonist. It's absolutely brilliant.
Thank you. It's very nice of you to say so. I wish I could say that I had a great master plan when I was writing it. You know, it began with these young men on a college campus, and then Helen introduced herself as a narrator after writing for maybe close to a year just these scenes in Uganda and trying to figure out who these characters were. And then suddenly I realized there was another half to this story, of course, and that was the half that takes place in the United States with Helen. And once she emerged and Isaac's voice emerged with hers, the two formed a sort of conversation. I never plot out or map my narratives, but as soon as you begin to invest, I think, a certain emotional depth to your characters, they begin to talk to one another. And Isaac and Helen are very much in conversation throughout the book. And so you can see certain scenes that happen in Kampala. For example, when Isaac and his friend they go to a cafe where they're beaten because they know they don't really belong. In Helen's chapter, she goes to a diner with Isaac where the two of them are overtly discriminated against because they know that this interracial couple doesn't belong. And I found all these ways that these stories can find traces of each other. You know, they can echo one another. Again, partly with that same idea that there are ways in which we can make bridges out of our narratives once we locate them in individual lives, once we begin to think of it not as the history of X country, but as the history of Helen and the history of Isaac. And then we can say, okay, actually now I can understand that story. I know what someone like Isaac has gone through because there are traces of that in my own life, even if I've never been to Africa.
Indeed. Well, Dino, you've also written and traveled extensively in Africa, throughout Sudan, many other countries, yeah. Rwanda, Congo, and so forth. Talk about your most recent observations. We talked about in the novel, of course, set in the 70s, and as Idi Amin was about to come to power, a very brutal time. How do you see Africa today, particularly those countries?
You know, one of the more frustrating things is sometimes you go to a country and you have lots of reason to be very optimistic because you know that the conflict may be sort of winnowing and coming to an end. And so, you know, I was in South Sudan a while back, and there seemed to be a great reason to feel fairly optimistic. Riek Machar was there. Salvatore Kiir was not in Juba at the time, but in Khartoum. And you had the sense that here was this country burgeoning and coming to life. And then, of course, now we can sort of see the frustrations of that reality. We can see the fact that Machar and Kiir weren't able to actually find ways of governing together and all the political violence that has been spilt as a result of that. And in Eastern Congo, where I was last, you have strains of violence that are persistent and that continue to remain, largely because, in my opinion, the state hasn't found a way to fill some of those vacuums. You know, there's a sort of absence of state function in large parts of that area. And so because of that, you have these, you know, non-state actors who continue to exploit that and who continue to exploit the population. So I'm never pessimistic at all about those things. You can recognize what the problems are is what I've tended to sort of believe, you know, and you can recognize that the solutions, by and large, are always political. And so the frustrating part that I always have is when we reduce the conversation of political violence or violence in general in Africa to causes related to ethnicity or religion, when in fact those are oftentimes tools that are being exploited by politicians in order to maintain their power or their authority. They exploit ethnicity, they exploit religion, and they use those as weapons against their own population. So knowing that, I tend to believe once we have better governments, that a lot of the problems that we, you know, continue to haunt many African nations will eventually fade away. You know, they're not the failures of the populations or the citizens, but of their governments.
I believe that what you say is very true, and we see that in CAR as well as South Sudan.
Very much so.
The use or the exploitation of ethnic and religious identities, which have nothing to do with the root of the problem.
Of course. And in places where you have such a long history of communal living, where there's no reason to suddenly believe that everyone woke up one day and decided that Muslims hate Christians and Christians hate Muslims. But it's very easy when you need to maintain wedges in a society to find out how to drive those wedges deeper, because it's a form of exploitation like anything else. You want to exploit the natural resources of a country. There's one way of doing it.
In terms of state building, do you see signs that that is going to happen? Of course, we see it in other countries which have stronger state structures. Maybe Senegal or South Africa, that have overcome, you know, some of these issues and have fortified their institutions. But these other places, CAR is almost a failing state, South Sudan, a fragile new state.
I would love to say that there was the sort of easy solution or answer to those problems. But, you know, I do tend to think when you see some of these countries that when you know what they've gone through to get to that point, so when you look at the history of CAR, well, there was very little time or energy actually ever spent building up those state institutions, right? Building the infrastructure of a society, building the infrastructure of a justice system, of an electoral system. Those things have always been fragile, and they've been fragile for a very long time. And so when they begin to eventually disintegrate, or when they collapse because of small pressure points, or because people have chosen to resort to violence as a form of political expression, I think the big surprise isn't that these institutions collapse or that these states collapse, but that they've managed to persist for so long to some degree. You know, the fact that CAR was able to maintain some semblance of a state given the long history and continual intervention of the French government in that country and the sort of destabilization that happens when you have these countries that are technically independent, but at the same time still very much tied and to some degree manipulated by the former colonial powers. It's not that it's inevitable, but that we have to sort of recognize the complexity of how that happened and not be so surprised. You know, like, it's not even a form of disappointment to some degree. You know, it's like these places never had all the chances that they deserve to begin with. You know, they never had the proper space. So even inside of South Sudan, well, South Sudanese government was constantly going to be undermined by what happens inside of Khartoum. So you were never, that state was always under duress from the very beginning.
Let's turn back to the United States and the African diaspora, and particularly the Ethiopian diaspora. It's a very strong community, very productive, very creative. Many are saying that African immigrants are perhaps becoming the next biggest growing community here in the United States in terms of immigrant communities.
Yeah. I mean, you know, African migrants have done incredibly well, actually. There's an interesting argument that, you know, the real model immigrants are actually sort of African migrants who come here and disproportionately send their children to college are sort of very well represented in universities across the country. And a large part of that, I think, is due because of the fact that there's an African-American community that it had been here since the founding of this country and basically waged the battles that we didn't have to wage. So African migrants were able to come here and sort of assume a lot of the space and privileges of all the other immigrants that have come to this country beforehand, but with perhaps even less stress because, you know, the sort of process of desegregation, of opening borders and opening barriers had already been done. And so suddenly you have, you know, a generation like myself who comes here. And although I may have experienced some racism and discrimination growing up in the U.S., that's such a marginal experience compared to what someone like me would have faced a generation ago, what my father would have faced had he been born here.
In terms of helping Africa get back on its feet, and when I say Africa, obviously, I'm talking about specific countries such as South Sudan or even perhaps what's going on in Ethiopia today. Some criticize the direction. Do you see a role for the African diaspora, and are they playing a role in terms of helping their brethren back home?
They're definitely playing a role. You know, they're playing multiple roles, I guess, is probably the best answer to this, because that role is both in the best interests of the country, but sometimes those best interests are very much aligned to, do you want to be careful, because you don't want to pigeonhole an entire community's responses, especially the one in the diaspora. But, you know, in the case of Ethiopia, where you can see a very, very active diaspora community that's deeply engaged with the politics of his country, and that in the best possible case are the loudest voices and advocates for an expansion of civil rights and for an expansion of democracy and for an expansion of press. A lot of that is coming from the diaspora community. You know, they are sort of vocal advocates, partly because they have the privilege of being vocal advocates here in the U.S.
Dino Mengistu, I wanted to ask you if you've ever done much research or looked into the Ethiopian community in Israel. Where they are part and parcel, of course, of the nation. No. We're talking about Ethiopian Jews.
The Falashas, yeah.
Mm-hmm, the Falasha.
I haven't done much. I mean, I know a marginal amount, definitely nowhere near the depth of someone who's actually, but I've never been to Israel. And so to some degree, everything that I would know is, you know, sort of secondhand reports and stories of, you know, Falashas who have been in Israel, feel profoundly Jewish, and yet at the same time are very much isolated from the Jewish state and don't actually feel like they will, you know, sort of ever fully be Israeli. You know, they may very well be Jewish, but whether or not they ever get to sort of be a part of Israeli society is a different question.
And I asked you that precisely because of your answer. I thought that it would be an interesting terrain for exploring this whole sense of multiple identities,
yeah,
or not, you know, really belonging to a culture, but, you know,
yeah,
it's at the same time feeling a sense of affinity to a variety,
yeah,
of backgrounds.
Yeah, and that's, and every country's sort of different that way. You know, I think America is quite unique in that you can advocate for that multiplicity here, even if sometimes the people might not like it. The country is by definition sort of without a singular identity. You know, there's no definition of what it is to be American. You can come from anywhere and really become American. We're not tied to a particular skin color. We're really not even tied to a language, as many people would like to believe. We do have so many languages in our country and so many people who are citizens who don't speak English the way we would like to think everyone is obliged to. And I think that's very different from what you see, say, in Israel or even in large parts of Western Europe. You know, I lived in France for the past 5 years. And they have a very different relationship with their African migrant population. So while I'm there, what people see right away is that I'm American. And I would have a very different relationship to the French community and French society if I were coming from a former French colony. They would see me, I think, in a radically different light, because that question of are they really French is suddenly posed in a way that it's not by my presence as an American.
All right. Well, the book is All Our Names. The author, Dinah Mengistu. Dino, I can't thank you enough for coming in, sharing your fabulous insights, and congratulations on your new book.
Thank you very much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Emily Kurtz for booking our guest. Our engineer was Kwasi Smith. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.